From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Government regulations can place unnecessary barriers on the food we eat. One free market activist in North Carolina makes the case, though, for freedom of the fork. State lawmakers continue to look for ways to improve public school safety. One legislator, though, raised concerns with his colleagues about schools ignoring common sense ideas that are already permitted under state law. The 2020 election is bringing political heavy hitters to the Tar Heel State. You'll hear highlights from a recent speech from U.S. Senator and former presidential contender Ted Cruz. And you'll learn the story of a Greenville surgeon. His cash-based services offer an unusual level of healthcare price transparency. Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
Well, the candidate field is largely set for November's general election, with North Carolina once again to be the subject of talk and intrigue as a battleground state at the national level, and with all sorts of fascinating races for statewide office here in our state. Carolina Journal is covering all the key races. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. He joins me now with a look at some of these very interesting matchups. Rick, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Donna.
All right, we're going to have a race for governor of North Carolina,
yes.
And we know that Democrat Roy Cooper, the incumbent, wants another term, but now he's got a real challenger.
Yes, Dan Forrest, two-term lieutenant governor, won his primary, I think, by a somewhat surprising margin. He's running against Representative Holly Grange from New Hanover County. Forrest got 90% of the vote in the primary, which was very interesting because he got a higher percentage of the vote than Roy Cooper got in,
right,
in his race against Ernest Reeves, who essentially was a placeholder on the ballot. I think Ernest Reeves had something like $1,000 worth of spending in his campaign, and Roy Cooper had who knows how much. But it's Forrest versus Cooper, the race everyone's been expecting since about January of 2017. And so we will see what happens
here.
Yeah,
those are two people with pretty different views on a number of issues. Any thought, Rick, as to what might be the key issues that will come out in this race?
Well, Governor Cooper's going to run against the General Assembly, basically, and against Dan Forrest as a proxy for the General Assembly, since as the lieutenant governor, he is the president of the Senate. But also, Cooper gave indications in his victory speech on election night that he was going to be on the road a lot campaigning for Democrats up and down the ballot. So he's going to be someone who is not just concerned about his campaign, but about the fate of Democrats primarily in the General Assembly, where the Democrats are not too far away from being able to conceivably take majorities.
And one big factor that will impact those down ballot races will be, most analysts would say, who the nominee for president is from the Democratic Party.
Right.
And at the time you and I are talking, we don't know yet.
No, we don't. We know that the Vice President Joe Biden got a big surge out of Super Tuesday, and that privately there are a lot of Republicans who would be very happy if Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont were the Democratic nominee, because it would be easier for down ballot candidates to run against Sanders. Then they wouldn't necessarily have to run against their Democratic opponents. They would just simply say, well, you want to elect a socialist. And they would be trying to put their opponents on the defensive. With Vice President Biden as a candidate, that's harder to do. You can certainly run on the record that the vice president has in his position on the issues, but it's much easier to say running against a socialist rather than running against a former vice president who's on the left.
And on the Republican side, it would not be a cakewalk for Dan Forrest with Donald Trump at the top of the ticket, because there's
right.
certainly controversy over President Trump and his behavior, the things he says and tweets, etc.
Right.
Likely the Democrats would say to Dan Forrest, hey, you're embracing the president of the United States, who is divisive in their view.
Well, And that's why the Sanders pick, if it is Sanders, the Democratic side, neutralizes that to a large extent, because both of them, both Senator Sanders and President Trump, are very polarizing figures in their own way, unifying to their base, but they are certainly not shrinking violets. And so it's the sort of situation that that will make it the dynamic change completely, depending upon whom the Democrats nominate.
A lot of calculations are likely to go on behind the scenes with their campaign strategists as to how to handle it, depending on how things look at the top of the ticket. Well, for the number two job in North Carolina, Lieutenant Governor, this is really fascinating because at the time you and I are talking, we have one candidate for sure for the Republicans, Mark Robinson, but we're not quite sure on the Democratic side.
Right. Representative Yvonne Holley of Wake County took the lead, won about 26% of the vote. The winning candidate needs 30% to avoid a runoff. And she's going to be running against Senator Terry Van Dyne from Buncombe County, who had just barely finished in second place. It was a very tight race among the top three contenders. And Senator Van Dyne advertised very heavily, outspent Representative Holley by a lot, and still did not come through. I think one of the subtexts of the Super Tuesday election was that Wake County performed really, really well. I mean, Democrats in Wake County did great, and Democrats certainly provided the margin of victory, or the margin of lead, for Yvonne Holley. And this is going to be an interesting race because a lot of Democrats are asking Terry Van Dyne not to request a runoff, and as of the time we're recording this, that decision hasn't been made yet.
What about on the Republican side? Mark Robinson, that may be a name unfamiliar to some of the electorate.
Yes, he is a political activist, African-American political activist from the Greensboro area, strong Second Amendment supporter. He gave a very fiery speech before the Greensboro City Council about his Second Amendment rights and the
and
like.
And that went viral.
That went viral. He won 32.5% of the vote in a field of about 12 candidates, which is which unusual in a lot of ways. For one thing, the high-profile people who were also running, former Congresswoman Renee Elmers was in the race. Mark Johnson, the superintendent of public instruction, was in the race. A couple of members of the General Assembly who spent a good deal of money didn't score in very highly in that. And so it's very likely that if we don't have a runoff on the Democratic side, we're going to have our first African-American lieutenant governor, perhaps in a long, long time, if not forever. I'm not sure what happened in the 19th century. I can't recall right off the top of my head. But so that would be a landmark election. The other thing, too, in discussions, I was thinking about, you know, Mark Robinson's not really well known in a lot of Raleigh political circles. And this candidacy reminds me a little bit of Representative Mark Walker in the Greensboro area, who had an incredible on-the-ground grassroots campaign when he surprisingly won both the primary and the election in the 6th Congressional District. I believe it was in 2014. And people didn't know him, but he really worked the grassroots well. And I think Mark Robinson has done the same thing. And so it's going to be a very interesting race in that regard.
You mentioned a name that is now essentially out of a job, and mm-hmm. that is Mark Johnson, who is the current superintendent of public instruction, but he wanted to be lieutenant governor, but he did not fare well at all in the Republican primary. So he's out of elective office.
Right. Only got 12% of the vote. And so a lot of people were wondering why he actually chose that race, because it's really difficult to defeat an incumbent Council of State member who runs for reelection. It happens very rarely. Mark Johnson was one of the people who did it, actually, and when he won against June Atkinson back in 2016. But for now, he's out of elective office, or at least he will be as of January.
Now, the job that he has right now, superintendent mm-hmm. of public instruction, the fact that he ran for lieutenant governor meant that was an open seat.
Right.
And we now have two candidates who have won their races. The Republican nominee is Catherine Truitt. The Democratic nominee is Jen Mangrum.
Catherine Truitt is the chancellor of Western Governors University's North Carolina campus. She defeated Craig Horn, long-serving representative from the Mecklenburg County area, who spent a lot of money on the race. And then Jen Mangrum is a UNCG professor who ran against Phil Berger, the Senate leader, as a Democrat, and didn't fare very well. But nonetheless, she's got some notoriety from that race.
You have to wonder, considering that in North Carolina, we know that year after year, we talk about how the whole governance of the education system, the K-12 system in the state, is really murky. Wonder if these two candidates will weigh in on that in addition to policy issues.
Right. That's going to be a big concern. Is it, what do they think about the way the schools ought to be structured and the finances ought to be structured, too?
Another race to follow. Of course, Carolina Journal will be reporting on all of these, so you need to stay on top of that. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. Rick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. A lot more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. We all eat food, and some of us spend a lot of time thinking about food. But few of us think much about government rules that limit our access to food. That's where our next guest steps in to offer help. Donald Bryson is president and CEO of the Civitas Institute, and he recently addressed the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society on this theme, Food Freedom, Barriers to the Fork. Donald, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mitch. It's always a pleasure to be on Carolina Journal Radio.
So when you're talking about food freedom, what are you talking about?
I'm generally talking about what are those government regulations that prevent us from having access to the food that we want to eat. I think we all probably in America anyway, maybe not some third world countries, but in America, we have access to sustenance. Where is that sort of entrepreneurial freedom, and not to mention just culinary freedom, right, to eat the foods that we want? And what are those government barriers that prevent entrepreneurs, whether they're farmers or people making cottage foods in their homes, to prevent them from getting into the marketplace? And I come at that from the standpoint that government is here to protect our rights and not necessarily to protect us, a much more libertarian point of view. And I think that in a lot of ways, government has overstepped and become more of the nanny state that we talk about an awful lot.
And this is something that should be of interest to a lot of people who are foodies and interested in more than just going to the grocery store and getting the large scale, big producer version of your foods, but some of the things that small businesses would be creating.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The easiest example to talk about regarding small businesses are what are termed as cottage foods. And these are small scale foods that people would prefer in their homes. Things like cakes, pies, pickles, dried spice packets, dried soup mixes, that sort of thing. And the FDA, the Federal Food and Drug Administration, set rules or guidelines on this a long time ago, and some states have gone beyond that and set even more stringent guidelines on those. And then some states like North Carolina follow the FDA guidelines, but then have a few additional labeling requirements and things like that. It makes it very difficult for people to honestly try to make a living out of their home because of all these requirements.
You mentioned some of them. Are these the types of things that few people outside of those industries really know anything about?
It is. It's a very niche thing. You're talking about, you know, people who bake stuff in their home, for an example, and the requirements are such that, you know, if you bake a type of bread, let's say if you want a sourdough bread, and then you have to go and contact the Extension Department at the Food Science how do I say this? You have to contact the Extension Service at the Food Science Department at NC State University. They will test your food so that you can get all the ingredients back for proper labeling. That's $100 per product. And if you're a small-time entrepreneur and you have seven different types of bread, that's $700. Not to mention which you have to, you know, if you're on municipal water, then you have to provide a copy of your bill to show that you're on municipal water. If you're on a well, then the state has to come by and test your well water. All sort of ridiculous things that prevent, you know, entrepreneurs from getting into the market. And we have to actually acknowledge $700 may not sound like a lot of money, but we also have to talk about just the chilling effect that having an inspector coming to your home has on an entrepreneur.
We are chatting with Donald Bryson. He is president and CEO of the Civitas Institute. Donald, some people will listen to what we're saying in there and they'll say in the back of their minds, wait a minute, but this is food. This is the type of stuff we ingest. It's important that it be healthy. It's important that it be regulated. Is it a case in which we don't need any regulations, or is it just that the regulations we have are too stringent?
I think that it's the case. In some cases, there almost has to be regulations, right? You know, on some very perishable foods, I think it's understandable that there are some regulations. But sometimes it's a little much. And I'll give you an example that you know, in this cottage food scenario that we're talking about, if I bake an apple pie or a cherry pie, I can absolutely sell that to any consumer at a farmer's market, out of my home, whatever. That's fine in North Carolina. But things that are a little bit more perishable, but not that much more perishable, like pumpkin pies and sweet potato pies as we get into the holiday season, I can't sell those out of my home because they're viewed as too perishable. Are we really at a point in North Carolina that sells 40% of the nation's sweet potatoes that we can't sell sweet potato pie? Like that just seems like a little bit much to me. And there's not sort of this subjective reasoning about maybe we're just pushing this a little too far.
And from that example, it sounds also as if maybe there's some selective enforcement that that perhaps two types of food that are very similar, one would face no or very little restriction, while another would be restricted so much that very few people would ever want to do it.
Right. That's absolutely the case. And this is a small item, but it's one that illustrates your point exactly, which is buttercream cakes with buttercream frosting. And every legal opinion that I could find on that were basically, look, buttercream frosting is very subjective. You're going to have to contact your local health department to find out if you can sell it or not. Wait, what? This isn't uniform between Buncombe County and Wake County. I don't really understand. And, you know, when we talk about this, we talk about food freedom. We do polling at the Civitas Institute. And we did a poll back in October and found that surprisingly people are very concerned about where their food comes from. Found that 71% of likely voters in North Carolina most of the time, or at least sometimes, check where their food comes from on the labels. 86% of likely voters said that it is important to them that their food comes from farms in the United States. 71%, again, or 72%, excuse me, came back and said that it's important to them that if their food can come from North Carolina at all, that is important to them. So people actually care where their food comes from. Surprisingly, it appears that self-described conservatives care more than any other demographic. And I don't have the data points on why that is. I think we need to ask a few more questions. But that's very interesting that people actually do care where their food comes from. And so the question is, why can't we have it more local if we want it more local?
Yeah, it sounds as if people want more local food, but government rules might be blocking them from getting access to it.
That's absolutely the case. And we find that not just with these cottage foods that we're talking about. There's also the issue of raw milk that comes up, what kind of milk you want. Sometimes it's very hard for small dairy states like North Carolina for people to get access to the food they want. Honey is probably overregulated. As a product, the USDA and the Department of Agriculture here in North Carolina don't regulate honey itself, but they regulate honeybees. And so, again, another example, I like honey. I had honey on my breakfast this morning and yesterday morning. But if you we sort of have a weird sort of regulation about honeybees in North Carolina. Municipalities and counties don't regulate anyone who has fewer than five beehives on their property. They can regulate where they are on their property, how close they are to the road, and that sort of thing. But if you take into account that beehives only really make 20 to 60 pounds, an average beehive makes 20 to 60 pounds of honey per year, then someone who has five beehives is only producing probably 8 to 25 gallons of honey a year. And that's not really enough to, you know, increase someone's livelihood very much. And that regulation is from the Honeybee Act, the Honey and Honeybee Act of 1977, hasn't been regulated in more than 42 years. And so maybe we go back and take a look at some of these regulations, maybe at a time when we need more pollinator insects and you know, we have a honeybee crisis in this country, a pollinator crisis. Maybe we let entrepreneurs have more hives on their property and try to keep, you know, municipal regulators off their property.
Well, as more and more of us are thinking more about the food that we eat, these are the types of things to definitely keep in mind, the work of regulators that can help prevent some of that local food from getting to you. Donald Bryson is president and CEO of the Civitas Institute. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch. It's always a pleasure.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers continue to look for ways to boost safety in public schools. A special state house committee could propose new safety measures this year. Meanwhile, at least one committee member has concerns about safety measures schools already should be taking. Republican Representative Keith Kidwell of Beaufort County recently outlined those concerns for colleagues. They include items such as the proper role of school resource officers, or SROs.
Of concern to me is I visited most of the schools in my district. In fact, by the end of next week, it'll be every one of them. And I've asked a lot of the same questions. We have got to do something to make sure that the basic safety measures are followed, such as I observed SROs sitting in the offices in many of the schools. I think they thought their job was to keep the chair warm while the children were going about the schools instead of doing things like checking doors and checking the parking lots and things of that nature. I also noted in one particular school, 9 doors that were left unlocked with direct access to the outside. That's not acceptable. And I'm hoping that these are the basic things we'll also consider when we make recommendations, is that SROs have job responsibilities that they'll fulfill on a regular basis to check up on the school. Another issue I ran into was cameras. They had cameras on doors to cover those doors from inappropriate entry that didn't work. These bare necessity items are something that we're going to have to make sure that we address when we look at this. And I would also suggest that we do this as quickly as possible. As I impressed upon one of the superintendents in one of my counties, when I called him about the 9 doors unlocked, he said, yeah, we're going to address that at our next board meeting. I said, excuse me? At what time today can you solve this problem? He said, well, I told you we're going to look at it at the next board meeting. I said, let me rephrase the question so you understand it. What time today can you address this problem? This stuff is important. These little things that should be done, the SROs not sitting penned up in an office in the middle of the school building where they can't see what's going on, cameras that aren't functioning, locks that are not kept locked, basic things you would think everybody should understand. I think that each of us, particularly on this committee, should take some time and go around and visit our schools and see what they are and are not doing and try and impress upon them to do the proper thing until we get this legislation out that hopefully will motivate them to do that.
That's State Representative Keith Kidwell, Republican from Beaufort County. He's outlining his concerns about safety measures within public schools in his district. Kidwell sits on a special state House committee. It could recommend new safety measures for the full House and Senate to consider this year. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. The 2020 election campaign is bringing some heavy political hitters to North Carolina. Among them, Texas Senator and former Republican presidential candidate Ted Cruz. Cruz started a recent rally in Raleigh with a joke about the year's first big election controversy.
Well, I have some breaking news for you. As of today, the Iowa Democratic Party is halfway through counting their votes. And finally, they're prepared to declare a winner, Donald J. Trump.
Cruz also focused on the presidential impeachment.
These are remarkable times we're living in. The United States Senate acquitted President Trump and rejected these ridiculous impeachments. It was a one-sided partisan show trial from the House of Representatives. It was driven by partisan hatred. And I got to tell you, having sat there, 100 senators sitting in a room 13 hours a day, not allowed to speak a word. You had U.S. senators twitching. We're not used to not being allowed to talk that long.
While Cruz couldn't speak in the impeachment session, he found another way to reach constituents and the American people at large.
When impeachment started moving, I made a decision to step up and do everything I could to lead the fight and to explain to the American people what was going on and explain to the American people the factual issues, the legal issues, and in particular that the Senate was going to follow the Constitution of the United States.
Yes, sir!
So one of the things we did is we launched a podcast on the first day of the trial. And we did the podcast every night. We would do it late at night when the trial wrapped up. So midnight, 1, 2 in the morning. And it ended up going from non-existent, never existed before, to skyrocketing up the charts. It became the number one podcast in the world. We had over 2 million downloads in just 2 weeks. Because I think the American people were hungry for substance to understand what was going on, not to have the nonsense and the lies and the propaganda that you see on the mainstream media, but actually to hear the truth about what was happening.
Cruz says people want accurate information.
I think there is a hunger on the part of the American people to hear the truth, to speak the truth, and to stand up for liberty. The day before the impeachment vote, we had the President's State of the Union address. I think that is the single best speech President Trump has ever given. Yeah. And it illustrated the incredible divide, the stakes that we're seeing in our country. The president talked about how we've got right now today the lowest unemployment in 50 years. Last time unemployment was this low was 1969. I wasn't even alive. That was when Neil Armstrong was taking one small step for man and one giant leap for mankind. President talked about how we've got right now today, we've got the lowest African-American unemployment ever recorded. We've got the lowest Hispanic unemployment ever recorded. And as the president went through each one of these, you could see the Democrats with their arms crossed, blaring, refusing to applaud. I get they don't like the president, but they're refusing to cheer for the American people. They're refusing to stand up for victories for the American people.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'll tell you what I thought was the quintessential moment is the president talked about how in the last 3 years we've seen 7 million Americans come off of food stamps and 10 million Americans come off of welfare. And not only did congressional Democrats not cheer, but they hissed. You could hear them. It was like you'd gone into some lefty college campus and they were mad at someone for not being politically correct. They're hissing. And I want you to stop and think about that for a second. Think about what that means. You look at 7 million people coming off of food stamps, and don't think of that just as an abstract number on the wall. These are real human beings. These are real lives. That means right now, today, in Raleigh, is a single mom who 3 years ago didn't have a job and was dependent on the government for her food. She's gotten a job in the last 3 years, and tonight she's going to come home to her apartment. She's going to open the door to her apartment with a bag of groceries in her arms.
Bless her.
She's going to set those groceries down on the kitchen table, and her kids, her son, her daughter, is going to look up at mom with a newfound respect. Because she's got the dignity of work. She's got the self-respect of providing for her families. And those are people's lives being changed. The partisan divide was, I think, illustrated sadly and profoundly when at the end of the speech, Nancy Pelosi stood up and ripped the speech in half. It was horrible. It was disrespectful. Although I will tell you, I did give the president a bit of advice. I said, next year, laminate the speech.
That's U.S. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas speaking recently in Raleigh. He turned his attention to the Democratic presidential contenders.
They are galloping to the left. They're embracing positions that are so far out there. Even a couple of years ago, those would not have been remotely in the mainstream. They're advocating raising taxes on every American. They're advocating open borders, making it no longer a crime to cross the border illegally. They're advocating aggressive gun control. Indeed, one of them, sadly, from my home state of Texas, said, damn right, we're going to come into your house and take your guns. We're seeing Democrats saying they want to take away the health insurance that Americans have all across this country, make the health insurance you have right now on your job illegal. We are seeing Democrats openly embracing socialism.
Cruz places the political contests in a larger context.
This is a fundamental divide. It is a divide between free enterprise and socialism. It is a divide between law and order and lawlessness. It is a divide between freedom and tyranny.
Cruz emphasized North Carolina's importance in the national political picture.
Listen, North Carolina is a swing state. Y'all are a purple state. You know that hundreds of millions of dollars are going to flood into your state. It is entirely possible the presidency of the United States will turn on the election outcome in the great state of North Carolina. It is entirely possible control of the United States Senate will turn on what happens in North Carolina. It is entirely possible control of the House will turn on what happens in North Carolina. And this race could be decided by a few thousand or even a few hundred votes.
Cruz warned his audience about what he labeled the crazy left.
They're going to show up and vote. Okay. They hate the president. And they will crawl over broken glass to vote for him. That means we've got a responsibility here to make sure everybody else turns out. The other side, the left, they are so angry. They are so shrill. How many radical leftists does it take to screw in a light bulb? That's not funny! By the way, I asked that a few weeks back. Someone in the back of the room called out, well, how many does it take? And I said, actually, nobody knows, because that would require work.
Cruz also warned his conservative audience to avoid mimicking the bad traits of their opponents.
Don't respond in kind when they're angry and hateful and showering ugliness. We should respond with love and joy and winsomeness, because you know what? Our ideas work. And theirs don't.
That's U.S. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas speaking recently in Raleigh as part of the 2020 election campaign. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. If you've ever had surgery, you already know it's a maze of consent forms, insurance paperwork, and a lot of jargon that really isn't the easiest to understand. But one surgeon in Greenville, North Carolina, is taking the mystery out of at least one aspect of the whole ordeal. He is offering patients transparent, cash-based prices. Julie Havlak is associate editor of Carolina Journal. She's been reporting on this innovation in the delivery and cost of healthcare, and she joins us now to talk about it. Julie, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
This is our first chance to talk with you, and hope it's the first of many times that you appear here on CJ Radio. Tell us about Dr. Wade Naziri. Who is he and what's he doing?
He is a surgeon. He started out at the local hospital, and many of his patients were getting weight loss surgery, and that's often not covered by insurance. And so many of them were coming to the hospital uninsured. And if you're uninsured and coming to the hospital, the chances of you getting a huge bill are astronomical, because unlike most people, you don't have an insurer protecting you for something called chargemaster rates, which essentially are set in a way that I've heard one surgeon compare it to the Arabian Bazaar. Whenever you go up as an American looking naive, the sender, like, it might be worth a dollar. He's going to rack up the price to 100. And you We'll maybe bargain it down to 80. You'll feel kind of good about yourself. The insurer is the person who has the leverage to bargain that down. It's like being with the local. But if you're alone, odds are you're going to pay $90. It's going to be a 90% price inflation, and you're going to walk away not knowing what's happened, but you have a huge medical bill. And this was happening to his patients. He had one patient who paid, I want to say, $54,000 for weight loss surgery. He provides the same surgery for less than $20,000.
How is that even possible that he can cut the costs like that?
Part of it is he doesn't have to deal with the middlemen. He doesn't have to deal with insurers. He doesn't have that paperwork. And the other part of it is so much of that is actually just profit. Many of our local hospitals are sitting on billions in unrestricted reserves, and that's not counting the money they funnel into building projects, restricted reserves, and various foundations. So essentially, he isn't making, he's not going to be driving a gold-plated Cadillac doing this, but he wanted to reduce costs for his patients. So he went to the hospital administration, he says, he offered a price, they wanted to charge a fee, it's called a facility fee, it's basically an overhead charge that the federal government lets them charge, that was twice the entire price he wanted to charge.
Oh my goodness.
And then you add anesthesia and a surgeon, and again, the patient is looking at a huge bill. So he decided to leave, start his own surgery center where he does provide transparent pricing.
Julie, one would think then that he's quite a popular guy in Greenville, North Carolina. How is this working out in terms of the competition? And are people like knocking down his doors to get the surgery?
He just started. So he's working on PR a little bit now. But if you look at other similar cash-based surgery centers like the Surgery Center of Oklahoma, they are not only nationally famous now, internationally famous, but they're also they're becoming sort of a force of negotiation. My own sister has to get surgery soon, and I've been looking up the surgeries prices on the Oklahoma Surgery Center. It's a good way to bargain your price down. If you know what someone can do the surgery for, you at least, once a huge bill comes, might think to question things like, for a bag of saline, I've been reading through people's medical bills. It costs about $1.07 to reproduce. You wouldn't know that from the hospital charges. Some will charge you $44. Some will charge you $66.
And the big thing is that particularly when insurance is involved and you have that third party, nobody really knows what's going on, because those of us who have insurance are used to paying a copay and a deductible. And then at the end of the whole process, you get a partial bill. But the vast majority of it is taken care of by insurance. And that makes it really kind of uninteresting to us to even understand.
It's certainly complicated, and many patients certainly don't know their way around what's happening. A lot of patients, it's beginning to change now. There's beginning to become some traction just because there's been such a focus on, most people are having in medical debt. They're struggling to pay for their premiums, especially small business owners.
You know, Julie, I can imagine some of our listeners might be thinking, that sounds like a great deal. I'm sure he's a great guy over in Greenville and all that. But can someone who's willing to offer a low price like that, you know, what about the quality issue? Is there any concerns about going into someone because, gee, they wouldn't be doing it cheaper unless there was something strange going on?
So the joke is that you should never get sick because you never know what might happen. Medical death rates from unexpected preventable medical mistakes are among the leading causes of death for Americans. So you should maybe have some hesitation. However, most of the studies have shown there's almost no correlation between quality and price, because why would there be? So much of what hospitals compete on, because quality metrics are often, again, they're not transparent. Why would they compete? Oftentimes, it's the lobby that matters. If you read Unaccountable by Dr. Marty, he has a horrifying story about two doctors. One of them was known as the Raptor for his unfortunate personality. The other one was known as Hodad, standing for Hands of Death and Destruction. Oh. Hodad was the charming one. Everybody, all of the important politicians, because he was charming, went to see him. The Raptor, who was famous for hands that were just glacial, didn't move. Often ended up operating on the homeless. Again, it's so hard to find quality. You're best off asking people in the healthcare field, like nurses, where they would go to get their surgery done.
You know, Julie, you have been reporting for Carolina Journal on the healthcare beat, essentially, and you're now becoming a wealth of knowledge about this. I can just imagine if anything happens and I need some sort of service, I'm coming first to you to find out what's going on. But here at the John Locke Foundation, of course, we want more transparency and want innovation, et cetera, to try to put some downward pressure on those prices and those costs. Are you finding that people are starting to understand that even if you have health insurance, it doesn't mean necessarily that your health care is going to be affordable?
I find that most often it's less people are beginning to understand in as much as they're afraid. So many of the people I've talked to have said they don't want to go to the hospital, they don't want to go to the doctor because they're afraid. And frankly, that's a tragedy because so many of the doctors that I've talked to don't even know about the bills. They just mean well by their patients. And oftentimes they're in a system that's stacked against the patient
and we know
can be good people in a broken system.
Speaking of broken system, we know that we've got some doctors who are now starting to practice what's known as direct primary care. Because they want out of the insurance business. Have you been looking at that?
I have been looking at that. That's fascinating. There's some really interesting cost savings that are beginning to come out where businesses are beginning to use those as an alternative. It's certainly interesting.
And what about telemedicine? You know, right now, as you and I are talking, the country and, in fact, the world is in the middle of the coronavirus. And we're now starting to read stories about public health officials saying, hey, this telemedicine thing, this is a prime example of why we should be developing this.
That's actually one of the best things about direct primary care doctors is they don't have so many of the administrative coding problems where charging for telemedicine has historically always been an issue. But if you charge more, it's no longer a more affordable service. Direct primary care doctors are actually fascinating in that because many of them, the way they most interact with their patients is FaceTime and the telephone and texting, which you don't always find.
Well, it's a pretty fascinating subject. We've been talking with Julie Havlak. She is an associate editor with Carolina Journal. Julie, a pleasure. Hope to have you back soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the show this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.